This is an interview for the University of Adelaide Architecture School History with Derek Kendrick on the 9th of July 2008. Interviewer Rob Lynn. Derek, I'm wondering if you could give me some background of what you did in England prior to, I guess the word is, being headhunted to come to Australia to teach at the University of Adelaide. What's your story educationally, at least?
Where do I start? Back at secondary school, we had a new headmaster. He comes into the classroom one day and he introduces himself to us. He said, "I've got a list of names here." He said, "Smith, you're going to Oxford. Jones, you're going to Cambridge. Robinson, you're going to Imperial College. Levinson, you're going in your father's bank. Smith, you're going on your father's farm." Went down the list. "Kendrick and White, I don't have anything for you here. What are you going to do with your life?" "I don't know, sir." "Come and see me at our office tomorrow morning." So, fear and trembling, I'm standing outside his office next day. "Come in." And of course, it's down to attention in front of this headmaster. "Have you made your mind up? What do you want to do?" No, sir. "Well, you've got to make your mind up. You're 16 years of age. We should know what you want to do." So I'm searching for something to say. "My next door neighbour's a builder, sir." "Oh, you're interested in that, are you? Okay, right." So he rummages around on his desk. He produces a piece of paper. He said, "Well, you'll be interested in this." "Oh, will I, sir? What is it?" "It's a degree course in building at Manchester University. It's the only course in Britain that you can get deferred from the army and you don't have to be a Bevin boy." "Oh, is it, sir?" And that's how I made the decision about my career.
Where were you brought up, Derek?
In Chester, in England. And I went to Manchester University and I got exemption from the army and 40 miles away from my hometown. I have to say that I failed every subject and the army got me in the end. So I went into national service as a clerk, a statistician, draftsman in the Royal Army Service Corps. I went in for 18 months, but that was extended because of the Berlin Airlift, and I got involved with the Berlin Airlift as a statistician at Buckeberg in Germany. When I came out, I knew what I wanted to do, and that was I went back to the course, and I got my degree. Not without some problems. I didn't care for the quality of the teachers, and I used to cut their classes. Till in the end, an Indian student friend of mine came into the YMCA in Manchester where we were living. "He's going to fail you, you know." "Why?" He said, "Well, you haven't done the work," he says. So I said, "Well, I'll take the work in, show him." And I'd done all the drawing work in half the time that he'd taken to explain it on the blackboard, fireplaces and whatever it was. Mm. And he was so impressed, because I could draw.
Had you been taught, or was it natural?
Natural. And the external examiner was W.J. Smith of the Royal College of Science and Technology, Glasgow. He was impressed. He called me in. He said, "I want you to come up to Glasgow and teach." So I said, "Well, I've got a job as a reinforced concrete engineer." "Yeah, but you can give that away and come up and teach." So I said, "How much wages are you offering?" And he offered £400 a year. Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, I'm getting £425 as an engineer." He said, "Well, I'm sorry, you cannot do any more than that." So, but I decided to go and teach in Glasgow because I had some experience of teaching in the evening classes, part-time evening classes to get some money to get through my course.
So what year would this be?
1952. Right. And after 6 years in Glasgow and developing with a fellow named Edwin Morris, some very early pioneering building science work for architecture students with this Scottish architectural historian professor. And every time there was a salary increase, I didn't get one. So I was now about five steps behind Edwin Morris. I decided to, I had to leave and get another job elsewhere. I got six jobs offered to me, all with increases in salary. I could have gone to Nova Scotia as a timber engineer. I could have gone to Kumasi in what was then the Gold Coast, now Ghana, to run a school of building. And having taught the students, I then had to build the University of Kumasi with the students. That was a challenge. Harfield Newtown as a head of a school of building, or inspector of schools of building in west of Scotland, where I decided to come to the new school of architecture in Adelaide.
Now, how were you approached to, about that, please, Derek?
It was just an advertisement in the Architects Journal, and I applied. And when I got the offer, I wrote to the South Australian Agent General in London, got hold of a 15-minute sound and colour film of prepared by the University of Adelaide, which showed in full colour how wonderful Adelaide was. I remember there was a block of flats, U-shaped blocks of flats on Melbourne Street.
Yes.
Which were the start of the film after they'd shown us this place called Bonython. We didn't know how to pronounce it, you see, in those days. And that was the clincher, this film.
This is AP Rose advertising.
Is it?
It is.
Okay. Yeah, it was good. It was good. But we came out for 3 years, and then the contract was extended for another 3 years, which was attractive because at the end of the second 3-year contract, you had 12 months study leave on full pay. And I thought that when I came out here, we'd be able to compare life in Australia with life in England and make a decision whether we wanted to stay here or go back. But the decision was actually made by the children, because we brought a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old out. And by the time we went back to England, they were aged 9 and 11, and we had another child. They had become Australian. What do I mean by that? Well, we were living in a housing trust house with an incorrect orientation, but the kids soon learned to play on the western side of the house in the morning and the eastern side of the house in the afternoon, and it was noticeable. They were learning naturally to keep out of the heat.
When you arrived in 1958, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Mid-year?
1st of September.
1st of September.
50 years ago in a couple of months' time.
Tis too. Were you made to feel welcome here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was met by Neville Hoskings at the airport. At the Outer Harbour. We came out on the Orsova, travelling first class, which was very nice. And they decided, instead of taking us through Port Adelaide, they'd take us along Lady Gowrie Drive with the palm trees to Glenelg, where we were accommodated at Broadway in a house about 50 yards from the beach. And I think we arrived on a Saturday. And on the Sunday, I walked the kids down to the beach, and it was a beautiful 70-degree Fahrenheit day. And we were absolutely shocked to find the beach empty of people, whereas if it was Blackpool, it would be absolutely full of people. We couldn't understand why people went on the beach on such a lovely day. But that's where we learned about some of the things that Australia had to offer. For example, how to burn the back of the hairs on your hand, or try to ignite a chip heater
Oh, they're disgusting things.
And the noise of rain on a tin roof, which was a completely new experience. We were there for how long? 3 months before we moved out to accommodation at Klemzig, and we've been there ever since.
So did you purchase this house at that
Yes,
point? At
yes.
that point?
No, no, no,
No.
no. Rental.
Rental, yeah.
Every time I went along to the old Bank of Adelaide, asked for a loan to buy the house. I think initially it was $3,000, then it was $6,000, then it was $9,000. The bank would say to me, "No, no, no, you're better off. You're having a subsidized rental. It doesn't make economic sense for you to buy it. You're better off not buying it." But eventually we did buy it, and just as well we did.
Now, Derek, in terms of what you found at the university, could you describe what the place looked like, please, when you first went there?
1958. There were these 19th century buildings in the locations where the Wills Building is at the moment. An old Prince of Wales lecture theatre, I remember once, which was a funny little place. There must be some photographs in the
Yes, there are.
archives of that.
There are.
We used to go to lunch in the old staff club, which was on the ridge, where the present security office and architecture building is located. Secure office used to be an old bungalow, which was occupied by A.P. Rowe, and subsequently, when A.P. Rowe resigned, the new Professor Jensen lived in that bungalow for a time before he built his bungalow on the hills above Glen Osmond called Bledlow. The mortuary building, which was the staff club building, had a scissor roof and clerestory. Wonderful, wonderful space. And had an Hungarian chef. He used to produce marvelous food in the evenings.
I've never heard that.
Yes,
No.
and he was the first chef when they moved into the new University of Adelaide Club building. What's his name? Can't remember. But no, it was a quiet place. I suppose one of the things that was pleasing to me and to any people was the friendship that was generated by the university administration at the time. I don't think it was just Vic Edgelow, the registrar, or David Mackay, the assistant registrar, but everybody in the top office. You got a message like, if anything happens to your family, the university will look after you. Don't worry. And in fact, I had occasion to put that to the test when my mother was very ill. My father had already died, and I got this message that she was dying, and would I go to England? And I said, "Well, I haven't got the money." But the university said, "Look, we'll vouch for him to Qantas, and Qantas set me up to go to UK." But in the end, I didn't go. But the university had been prepared to offer that kind of support, which is missing today, sadly. But that was the kind of quality of experience that you had.
Harry Wesley Smith would have been academic registrar
Harry
then.
Wesley Smith, yes, and
Yeah.
his three sons were just
Yes.
learning how to play.
That's right.
No, Harry was wonderful. Had occasion to go to Harry one day in my office. An Asian girl came running into my office, and she was crying. Second year student. "Why are you crying?" "I'm going to have to go home." "Why?" "Well, my father can't afford to pay anymore." Well, what's happened? Well, you probably read in the paper about the typhoid epidemic on the Malaysia-Thailand border. Well, it's my father's ice cream factory, and he's been put out of business. So I said, oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. And I went up to see Harry Wertley Smith, and I said, Harry, I've got this situation. Can you do anything about it? He said, leave it with me. And about a week later, the girl came, the same girl came running into my office and said, Mr. Kendrick, what? She said, I've got a scholarship. Have you? She said, I don't have to leave. I said to Harry afterwards, where the hell did you get the money from? He said, oh, I have ways. There was a philanthropist. I don't know who it was, but my guess was it was Mark Mitchell that he'd spoken to. So that was the kind of university that we had in those days.
Mm. So was there a sense of familyness about it, if that's the way of putting it?
Yes, yes, yes. All new migrants didn't have any, most new migrants didn't have any relatives out here, and so we became the pseudo aunties and uncles of each other. Mm. And that's how the friendships developed. The Hoskins family, I became their pseudo uncle, and subsequently when I married Neville Hoskins' wife's half-sister, I became a real uncle, and that is highly valued today by the Hoskins family.
As an aside, how did he ever get the nickname Tex?
Have you never seen his legs?
Yes, I have.
They were bow-legged, but he died recently, yeah, by the way. Yeah. His children spoke to me about that, and they think it was the Czech shirts.
Oh yes, okay.
That he wore. Together with the bow legs. But no, he enjoyed that.
Derek, your teaching would have taken place in, was it the top story of the engineering building, is that right?
Hang on, they've got to get this story right. Yeah. When I arrived in 1958, in September, the school had started on the 17th of March, and Jensen and Hoskins and Miss Weiss, the secretary, Margaret Weiss, they occupied the second story at the southern end of the mechanical engineering building.
Yes.
It was a large room, and to one side there was a smaller studio, and at the far end there were a group of offices, and that was the School of Architecture in 1958. By 1960, the third floor of the civil engineering building at the western end had been raised on jacks, which was Louis Laidborn Smith's wonderful idea that you could expand the building upwards, and that the roof was designed to be lifted. And we moved into the western end, where we had two studios, one crit room, a materials museum, a photographic dark room, an honors studio, a lecture theater with a bio box at the back, and a building science laboratory.
So it's quite an extensive array of rooms.
Yes.
And space set up particularly for the course.
Yes.
What was the course would have already been structured by the time you arrived, I suppose.
Oh, yes, yes, everything was in place. It was in the calendar. Jensen's course was, I suppose, to create the universal man, if you can accept that word today. Four prongs. Architectural design taught by him. Construction taught by Hoskins, structural engineering taught by Frank Bull and the civil engineering staff. They weren't going to relinquish their connection, and building science taught by me over the 5 years of the course. But the syllabuses were all in place when I arrived, and in terms of my field, the guide for that building science prong of the course was set up by the Royal Institute of British Architects in 1943 and 1947, when the Institute of British Architects decided that the shortcoming of architects was they didn't have enough engineering, physics, chemistry in their education to make them fully proficient architects. And committees of the Royal Institute of British Architects looked at what needed to be done, and building science course with building science laboratories was their recommendation in these two papers. Professor Henry J. Cowan, known as Jack Cowan, an engineer, was the first professor of architectural science in the world, was set up in Sydney University in 1955, I think, and Jensen went across to see him, as well as Ashford at Sydney University, Towndrow at the University of New South Wales, and Brian Lewis at University of Melbourne, who were all ex-Liverpool University graduates. Professor Jack Cowan was a civil engineer from Leeds University, I think. And so their, his experience of talking with them provided the basis for his design of the course.
Had you known of Jensen prior to coming here?
No. I did a bit of homework and I found out that he'd been the Rose Shipman Scholar, which meant that he'd been able to visit Scandinavia and to study multi-story housing. I hadn't realized that at that time multi-story housing was not going to be very looked upon very favorably here in Adelaide. But he had a background of Royal Engineers during the war, town major in Malaysia, and prior to that, before the war, he was an architect in Singapore. And one of the things that I subsequently learned about Professor Jensen was that before he came to Adelaide, when he was the chief architect and planner at Paddington in London, was that he told us that he was on the communist blacklist, but so was Sir Harold Macmillan as the housing minister anyway. But Jensen was a person who built multi-story blocks of flats in Paddington. And he and Abercrombie, Sir Patrick and Abercrombie, who had rebuilt Plymouth after the war damage that was done there. And Abercrombie was a low-density, low-rise architect and planner. These two were always clashing at RIBA meetings and Royal Institute of Town Planning meetings.
They were both firm in their views, Derek.
Oh, yes. You can read about it. It's in the RIBA journals and the Royal Town Planning Institute journals. It's an interesting opposition of views.
So, Derek, you said you had no knowledge of Jensen when you arrived.
No.
And you've explained the course structure. What about the students? This was the next thing I was coming to. What were they like?
Can I tell you something before that?
Yes, certainly.
Just a little story about Professor Jensen. I went to a function at Enfield and met up with several local architects, and they were up in arms about Professor Jensen. So I said, why? It turned out that he has set up in practice, and they were concerned about their practices suffering because somebody with a titled professor is going to, in their view, take work away from them. And on the Monday morning, I thought, well, I better tell the professor about this. So went into his office about 9:30 on Monday morning and said to Professor I had something important to tell him, that the department and the faculty was being maligned by architects. Professor Jensen said, oh yes, in what way? So I told him, and who are they? And immediately I froze and thought, what am I letting myself in for? And I said, I'm not telling you. And for 3 hours I held firm before I was released from his office. I think on that particular day he gained my respect. And that may very well have been the reason why later on, much to my great surprise, in 1970, when he was going on overseas study leave, he asked me to be the dean of the faculty. And he said the reason he wanted me to be the dean was because he trusted me, whereas he didn't trust the other members of staff who were, in my view, were more likely and more suitable to have been dean at that time. But you're asking about the students. I think you need to know what happened at the very beginning. In 1958, when the new school course started, students at the Institute of Technology School of Architecture were invited to apply to enter the University School of Architecture if they had matriculation. And that the university, for its part, would grant them exemption for the first 2 years of their university course if they wanted to come into the third year of the architecture course, or 1 year if they wanted to come into the second year of the architecture course. And there were 7 or 8 students entered the third year, there were 7 or 8 into the second year, and we had about 30 new students into the first year. So we already had about 50 students when the doors opened to the school, and three years of courses to teach. There's some pretty bright students transferred into the School of Architecture. Michael Griggs, in the very first third-year cohort, he became the president of the Architectural Student Society. And with Jensen's encouragement, they got Sir Arthur Stevenson from the University of Western Australia School of Architecture to become the patron of the Architectural Students Association. And indeed, Sir Arthur Stevenson was the first external examiner of the first set of graduates in 1961. And he came across as an external examiner to ensure and maintain the standards of the final thesis presentation, which was a pretty substantial piece of work in those days. I can't remember all of the students in that very first third year group, but Michael Griggs, Battersby, Jack Russell, I can't remember.
Oh, that's okay.
I don't expect you to remember all of them, but you'd been used to teaching in Scotland. Was there a difference between the types of students here and there, or much of a muchness?
No. The University of Adelaide students were the same, but I didn't understand what they had just recently been involved with, which was something called Bohemia. And if you walked on the university campus down the brick staircase from the upper level to the lower level by the Students' Union, in the garden on the left there, there were some sculptures and pieces of work which the remnants of this Bohemia activity that they had been working with, or presenting, or having a conference or convention about. This bohemianism was a strange thing to me, but 2 or 3 years later, the form it took was interesting. The students were instructed by Jensen to organize the faculty dinner, and they did. And when the staff turned up in evening dress and the women in long dresses, they were horrified to find that the students were all dressed in sackcloth and ashes. But this was Bohemia, and we didn't even know the meaning of the word Bohemia. And they were drinking wine and beer out of tin cans. It was a complete play down of life. And Jensen was horrified, particularly as he had some guests there from the Institute of Architects, including Ken Milne, the old Ken Milne, and his wife Hazel, who had made these wonderful donations of travelling prizes to the school. And later, having put the squeeze on the students, the student body then reorganised another faculty dinner specifically for the staff and guests of the professor. And this time, in the union, a hall had been decked out in Palladian architectural style, and one Sandy McClay, architectural student and girlfriend, turned up in a horse-drawn landau, just to set the scene. So the students were very bright and very creative, as were the general student body of the University of Adelaide. You've got to understand that at that time, when the students had their rag day, as we called it in Manchester, prosh day, they always had a theme, whether it was Aborigine issues, primary school education issues, hospital issues. The students had a voice, and they wanted the public to know that they had concern. That's sadly all gone from the university. From the university life of students, it's just a pity. It's a completely different world.
I'm just recalling, Derek, that the year you arrived, Union Hall would have been open too, the theatre.
Yes, I didn't see it as a newly opened building, but yes, I subsequently made acoustic measurements in there to show that it was awful. That there was a band of about 5 or 6 seats, which didn't get any reflections for the ceiling. And if you got in those seats, they were the worst seats in the place. They were about 8 rows back from the front, a band of about 3 or 4 rows. Hmm. It's still there, the defect.
They didn't fix it. But it interested me that so many people actually involved in the university had an interest in that particular hall, the building of it, and what it stood for.
Yeah, Harry Medlin.
Yes.
But if we deal with the architecture students, many of the architecture students got themselves involved with the stage theatre. Its lighting, its the preparation of the props for whatever shows were being put on. And indeed, they... some of them gave up the architecture course and became involved in art as art teachers, or became involved in theatre. Just trying to John Dulwitz was one.
Yes, of course.
Young Snyder was another one who left when he died early, sadly, and he left a donation of an art prize and a sculpture prize to the school. The school has never ever awarded the sculpture prize because we've never ever had a sculpture course. But that was the way they looked upon their education. It was beyond the actual syllabus, and they made a career out of it.
Was Professor Jensen's view of how the course should function very regimented in his, you know, in the style that he'd come from?
I think Jensen's course was unique. I don't think he copied anybody's course. He designed this course to create the complete architect. Somewhere I've written that I thought his course was aimed to create the universal person, the universal man, as they called it, the absolute complete architect. In addition to the syllabus, the taught syllabus, the studio work, there were a whole stack of additional arrangements of talks by experts at lunchtimes on a weekly basis. There were site visits to manufacturing industries, to building sites. There wasn't an aspect of architecture that was not covered by the course. Subsequently, when the Australian Institute of Architects magazine did a survey of architectural courses in Australia and the hours spent on the courses, the timetabled hours for the architecture course in University of Adelaide was twice the weight of any other course in Australia. And Jensen made no apology for that. So the others are inadequate. He was very proud of what he was creating. And if you talk to students today, I'm talking now 2008, right, yeah. And you look around at that crop of students that attended that first 18 years of the University of Adelaide architecture course, and you ask them about their course, they all know that they've survived, because that's the only word you can say, but they're all exceedingly grateful for the background education that he provided for them. They don't hold a candle to anybody. They are the tops in their own view. I don't personally hold that view. I think a lot of the later work, particularly of David Sanders and the computer work of Tony Radford, have changed the scene. And there isn't time to teach students everything. What Jensen didn't do, which the new courses do, is teach you how to learn and how to progress your own knowledge.
That is a very interesting observation, Derry. Very, very interesting. I have not heard anyone else make the same observation, I must say.
Okay. The David Sanders course, if I may go on to that.
Yes.
There is an aspect of that which I don't think is fully appreciated. It'll take a moment to tell the story. After Jensen, it was inevitable that the university would choose a different kind of person to lead the architecture school. And in David Sanders, an architectural historian and architect, they found that person. David Sanders interviewed everybody and found out what their talents were and what their interests were, and he proposed to design a course to accommodate everybody's interests, plus what he wanted to do. When he presented the first course plan to change this five-year course, which we'd all worked on for 18 years, well, those had been there since the beginning, we were absolutely shocked. He wanted to have a three-year academic course without any drawing at all, followed by a 2-year professional course. No way. You can't create an architect with a course like that. And there was opposition. And I have to say that many of the staff who were silent looked upon me to lead the opposition to this proposal by this new professor. We were horrified. And I did. And I opposed it. I couldn't see how this new course could turn out a responsible, high-quality architectural graduate. What happened then was stubborn David wouldn't move. There was a standoff for 18 months. Following a summer break, David Sanders came back and said, I'm going to make an alteration to the plan that I proposed before. And one of the major things he proposed at that time was to allow students from the second year of the first 3-year degree to transfer directly into the professional course, provided they had a credit standard. And that the second course, instead of being a 2-year course, would be a 3-year course.
Yes.
Now, when he, having been so stubborn and holding, made this move, I thought, well, personally, he's made a move to accommodate our opposition. I don't think we're ever going to win anymore. We're not going to go back to the old 5-year course. So I will support David. And that was probably the most wonderful decision I ever made, because David and I became very close friends, and David, as a friend, had a shortcoming. That was he hated administration. And the relationship that we established was that, because I liked administration, I could do that stuff standing on my head. David told me what he wanted to achieve. I wrote the rules, regulations, that would achieve those objectives. And that was how we worked together. And we became very, very close friends, so much so that his family invited myself and Albert Gillison to be pallbearers at his funeral, which I still think was a wonderful measure of the closeness of that relationship that I had with David. And subsequently, my second wife, Doris, formed a close relationship with Doreen Sanders, David's wife, and the family became very close to my second wife, Doris.
Derek, may I just ask you something? The way I understand, and you've described Professor Jensen's era, is that he was the professor.
Yes.
If you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
In the old mould.
The God professor.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at.
Yes, he was a God professor. Well, all the professors in the university in 1958, when I arrived, were God professors.
And what I'm moving to is that it seems to me, from what I'm getting up to this point, is that, from my own research, is that when David comes on board, David Saunders...
Yes.
It is not the same type of God professor image that he wishes.
No.
He wants, as you've said, to have people involved with their strengths and abilities.
Yes.
And it seems to me to become much more of a team effort. I'm not saying that you didn't all contribute. Of course you did under the early times. But David willingly wanted you involved, if that's the way of putting it.
Yes. Let's make a couple of comments here. Jensen made the assumption that every staff member could teach everything. And when he was designing the teaching loads, if you were given a class to teach interior design, but I've never taught that in my life. Well, you're going to now. He expected you, as a competent architect, to be able to teach anything that you were given. And the staff just had to knuckle under because he was the boss. We survived.
Yeah.
For my part, though, with David Sanders and what he wanted me to do with building science, he virtually destroyed the course that I'd built up.
Mm.
With the old RIBA
mm-hmm.
View of the way in which building science should be integrated into an architecture education. In the first degree of David Sanders' course, he wanted me to teach building science as an academic subject. And I was horrified at this because I was teaching building science as an applied subject, which is what was needed in practice. And we talked it through, and he said, well, I want you to spend a whole term, and subsequently it became a semester, on one topic. So I said, what are you going to choose? And I thought about it, and I thought, well, building materials and water. That's what I developed as a course, because building materials and water are the thing that one most important things in relation to building, and you can teach everything, but it was had to be academically taught. What I did, because I was worried about the caliber of students' science background coming into such a course in the second year, by the way, not the first year, in the second year, was that they wouldn't have enough grounding. So I prepared some notes on preliminary learning for building science, which involved the study of water, like the old sort of Christmas party tricks of a needle floating on blotting paper on in a glass, putting pepper on the meniscus of water, and then one drop of with dishwashing liquid in the center, and the stuff moves out to the edge, and then asking the students to A, observe, and B, to explain what was going on. One of the most interesting things that arose in preparing for this course with the study of water was capillarity. I would always been under the impression that the finer the capillary tube, the greater the amount of suction that took place, and the higher up the vertical walls. It's wrong. I went back to 1890 physics books, looking at capillarity in those days, and I suddenly realized, I realized that what I'd been taught, what I understood, what the textbooks were saying was all wrong. In fact, it's pressure that forces the water up, not suction up. So being caused to study something academically meant you'd made a personal discovery which you didn't know about. How to teach building science and applied science academically was a challenge I didn't enjoy. But I thought, well, what can I do? And in a second semester course, I decided to look at building science history and give the students work to do on Sabine and the history of acoustics and how reverberation time first came into play by Sabine's work for his own PhD in America. I looked at the power law of physics as distinct from the Weber-Fechner law. I looked at discomfort glare. I set one student a project to look at the lighting standards in America compared with lighting standards in Europe and in Britain, and to work out why the American lighting standards required 10 times more light than the British and the American, than the British and the European standards. Trying to teach an applied science academically, I didn't find easy, I must say. But to me, I wasn't wasn't teaching something, or I wasn't encouraging students to study work that, in my view, was as directly applicable as before. And I don't think it was helping this business of teaching students how to learn about stuff. May I go back to the Jensen course? One of the successes I believe I had with the Jensen course was when I went in to see him fairly early in the piece, about 1963, saying to him, I don't want to set an examination in final year building science. Oh, why not? I said, I'd much prefer them to do a research project for me. I said, if you think about these students, they've been in the university 5 years. Other students are in the second year of their master's degree and doing research. So, all right, but make sure the standards are high, which was reasonable. I mean, I was interested in standards, in high standards. And what I created was this. Any student could put up a proposition to me that he would do research in any field that they liked, any field that they liked, provided it involved measurement or observation and deduction and application in an architectural or town planning context. And they could do what they liked. Okay, I met some interesting problems. Rod Lawrence, for example, who is a very bright spark these days, he's runs a brilliant course in Switzerland in building construction. He's United Nations advisor on housing. He's a very bright student. He came along and he wanted to do something on, for memory, vision and what it is people see in architecture. And I said, well, how are you going to do that? He said, I'm going to write a questionnaire. I said, no, you're not. What do you mean? How am I going to get the information? I said, well, the questionnaire is not just something you're going to write. It is something you're going to design. The questionnaire is a scientific instrument. It's you're going to use to measure what it is you're going to look at. And you can get off down to Flinders University and talk to the visual arts department down there about how you design a questionnaire. Then you can come back, then you can do the project. And this is the way in which each individual student had to be dealt with or handled. Tell you another illustration. A student comes up, and kind of emotive student. Well, what would you like to do? I won't tell you his name because it could be embarrassing. But he's quite well known around Adelaide. What would you like to do? And the arm starts playing around like a windmill. Urban design. Oh, yes. I know immediately that I'm going to have to squeeze because you can't do a building science project on urban design. So after about an hour of squeezing, which wasn't easy, but every case is an individual, and you have to work the project that they're going to do in terms of the student's interest, but also in terms of your judgments of the student's capacity to deal with it. And I squeezed this urban design fellow down to the public seat. Come back in a week's time and tell me what you think. So a week's time, he comes back and he's all enthusiastic. He said, I've been looking at people sitting at bus stops. Oh, yeah? What have you found? He said, they don't sit square on the seat. They sit at 45 degrees, looking at the direction to where the bus comes from. So I said, well, that's observation, that's good. Now what else? And he didn't get much further than that. And so I had to make suggestions to him. Mm. I said, well, look, this is your final research project in the School of Architecture. You've got to enjoy it. You've got to go and look, use your eyes. Consider the public seat as a piece of sculpture, a work of art. Oh, yeah, yeah. Consider the public seat as a meeting place. Oh, yeah, yeah. Social. Oh, yeah. Consider the public seat as a bed. Oh, God, you mean when the tramp... Yeah, when the tramp lies on the... Consider the public seat as a restaurant,
mm.
when people have a meal. The totality of your urban design project is there in that one object. That's your topic. A very satisfied student. But each individual student had to have individual treatment to give them something they could fulfill. Doug Alexander of Flight Path.
Yes, yes, I know Doug.
He did a project on door handles. And he, if you like, pioneered the use of videotape, the way in which people and the hand gripped doorknobs and lever handles and so on. He was actually achieving for me exactly what I wanted them to do, learn how to look, learn how to observe, which is what science is all about. And obviously a basic talent. if I could step back. In between the two professors, I was the head of department and dean of faculty, and one of the responsibilities was selecting students for honours. And this particular year, I was faced with a problem as dean. No staff member would offer to take any honours course. We've got enough teaching to do, we don't need to do any more. And they had a dozen students who were going to do honours. And in the Janssen course, it was 4 years, the fourth year and the fifth year.
Mm.
So I went along to the students in the fourth year and said, well, I'm very sorry, I haven't got any staff to offer honours courses to you, and as it's got to start next week, I'm going to have to take them myself, and the only course I have, because I can't prepare special courses for you, the only course I have available is climate and architecture, and the way in which I teach climate and architecture is I use Marston Fitch's Scientific American article about what he calls primitive architecture, and which I prefer to call pre-literate architecture. And I will assign a pre-literate architecture topic to each of you, and each of you will make a presentation on that pre-literate architecture. So you might have Java, you might have Japan, you might have Finland, you might have Mexico, and so on. And I said, that may not be what you want to do, but I said, look, you do that for me this year. We'll bind it all together in a nice folder, and it can go into the shelf in the book room, the department resources room. And next year, when you come back in fifth year, I'll still be your honours supervisor. I'll let you do anything you want. We had a wonderful year in fourth year, and they produced a wonderful document about pre-literate architecture of each of these different places, and I think they got a kick out of it.
Mm.
They came back into fifth year, sat down with them. Now, what do you want to do? And Andrew Davis said he wanted to do colour. Somebody else said they wanted to do whatever they wanted to do. And I can't remember this other student's name, but his father was a reader in the Institute of Technology. He was a very bright cookie student. He said, I want to study hypnosis and architecture. I said, what? He said, I want to study hypnosis and architecture. Why? He said, well, I'm interested. Well, I can't supervise that. Yeah, but you promised I could do anything we liked. Yeah, I know I promised that, but I thought you were going to come back with a subject that I'd be able to supervise. Well, I really want to do hypnosis and architecture. What's the connection? And he told me a story about a man, major in the American Army, who had been damaged, having been a prisoner of war by the North Koreans. Mm. And he'd now come back. He was in hospital. And how, as part of the treatment for his recovery, the psychiatrists had hypnotized him and sat him in front of a window and said, look, we know you're good at watercolor painting. There's an easel, there's your watercolors. Paint the scene outside the window, but you're under his hypnosis. And the major did this. And then under hypnosis, they, next time they placed him in front of the window, they said, and today we want you to paint the view through the window in the past. And the next time they placed him in front of the window, we wanted to paint the view through the window in the future. And each of the paintings was different. Mm. Now, I don't know what the significance of that was to the psychiatrist, but this architecture student thought that there was benefit to him in actually studying these thought processes in terms of visualization. And, oh, God. Yeah, but you made a promise, sir. I said, well, give me 24 hours to think about it. Yeah, but you remember you did promise. It was brutal. So the next day, having thought about it, I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? Keep my promise. Got to keep my promise. So when we met again as a class the next day, I said to him, I'm going to give you permission to study hypnosis and architecture. You are? Yeah. But I won't be supervising you. Well, who will? The professor of psychiatry will be supervising you. I've spoken to what's her name? Izzy Pilofsky.
Yeah, Izzy, yeah.
And he had agreed to supervise the student. And the student was dumbfounded. His bluff had been called. But at the end of that semester, when we had the presentation by this student, and Izzy Pilofsky was with this seminar group, it was one of the most interesting presentations we've ever had. So again, following what I said before, you never, privately before the meeting, you never knock back a student's idea. If you can find a way of encouraging it, you always should.
Now, Derek, following from that, you pioneered this use of projects in the fifth year in the Jensen era.
Yeah.
Did that carry over to the David Saunders era and beyond?
No, it died. That was my sadness, you see.
Mm.
There were some wonderful things that were done. For example, Andrew Russell works in the town hall, Adelaide Town Hall. For his project, he decided, this is the year I was away on study leave and Brian Atkinson took over, and he knew what it was all about. Mm. And Andrew Russell had put a proposition to him. He would like to design a building science game, a card game, where you did something, and there was a pack of cards for how you build a multi-story office block using these cards. And so Andy Russell got a lot out of it, because he had to look up how to design a game and what games were all about. So game theory. so that it, that was useful. The hell's the other, what's his fellow's name? Another student, a wonderful piece of work. This was a thermal project. His father had a garage where he could get access to soldering irons and resistors and things like that. And he actually created a piece of equipment which would show the transfer of heat going through a cavity wall. And you could actually measure the transfer of temperature through the cavity wall. One of the most interesting projects which continued over a period of time with these was the urban heat island over Adelaide. I'd learnt about that during my study leave at University College London in 1965. They had done a heat island study in London, and what they had done was they had driven a car around about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on diagonal paths, radial paths across London, and they had an instrument on the roof of the car, and recorded the temperature from the outskirts of London all the way in across London and out the other side. So they did these cross paths, and I worked it out that I had the anemometer. We built a silver tube, fastened it to the roof rack, and put the instrument inside it so it was protected from the sun, and had a student driving the car and a student in the back with the instrument recording the readings, recording the temperatures. And they drove from Jepps Cross to Darlington, passing West Terrace, and at West Terrace, that's where the Weather Bureau used to be.
Yes.
And so at 11 o'clock in the morning when they passed, they had a time connection with what the temperature was there, and you could adjust the data back to this corresponding. Then the following year, we had a student who went from Henley Beach through the town to the Adelaide Hills. We had these graphs of temperature change across the city. Now this one proved to be very interesting because the temperature rose and then dropped as you went to the little squares, Victoria Square, and rose again when you were between the buildings, dropped again in the parklands. So this showed that the heat island effect was within the built area. And subsequently, students actually studied the four squares, the little squares and the big square. And I'm sure they got a hell of a lot out of it. But students did anything they wanted. I mean, if we had the equipment, they could go out and do it. Acoustics, they wanted to do acoustics, they could do acoustics. For example, what's his name? Can't remember. The daughter of the professor of mechanical engineering at the time, she wanted to look at noise through open doors.
Is that Susan? No.
Is it Susan?
Susan Shannon? No.
Susan Shannon's father was at Waite Institute.
Waite, of course he was. Yeah, sorry.
Now this is mechanical engineering. Davis.
Davis. Yes.
Davis. Professor Davis. His daughter. She wanted to look at doors, and she did it actually in her father's offices over the weekend because when it was quiet, and you have noise in a corridor, and you could have the door half an inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, and see the effect of noise. Anything they wanted to do, they could do. Don't ask me where all the stuff's gone. I think it's been destroyed, which is very sad because I thought there was some very interesting stuff there.
Yeah.